KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
First, we're going to get rid of fact-checkers.
Rid of fact-checkers. Weeks after meeting Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg announces sweeping changes to Facebook and Instagram, including the end of third-party fact-checking in the United States. We'll look at how Meta's decision to lose content moderation could impact Facebook's 3 billion users around the world. We'll speak to Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa in the Philippines and more. Then we go to Los Angeles, where devastating fires have killed at least 5 people, destroyed 2,000 homes and buildings in what could be one of the nation's costliest climate disasters. Over 130,000 people have evacuated.
Tonight, more people may get evacuation orders, and if they do, please leave immediately. If you have an evacuation warning, get ready to go.
We'll speak to John Valiant, author of Fire Weather, on the front lines of a burning world, and Los Angeles radio and TV host Sonali Kohatkar. She had to evacuate her family yesterday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 5 people have died, 130,000 people ordered to evacuate as multiple wildfires continue to rage in the Los Angeles area, destroying at least 2,000 structures. The Palisades Fire, which is believed to be the most destructive ever recorded around Los Angeles, has burned more than 17,000 acres, razing homes and businesses along the iconic Pacific Coast Highway. The Eaton Fire has burned over 10,000 acres, including many structures in Altadena and Pasadena. Firefighters appear to have fought back much of the Sunset Fire, which exploded late Wednesday, prompting evacuation orders around Hollywood. Red flag fire warnings are expected to remain active in L.A. through Friday night as heavy wind gusts and dry air continue to fan the flames. But officials say the most erratic weather patterns are believed to be over for now. Los Angeles may Mayor Karen Bass addressed the monumental scope of the wildfires at a press briefing Wednesday.
This firestorm is the big one in magnitude. Hurricane-force winds are usually accompanied by rainstorms, but these are hurricane-force winds that are combined with extremely dry drought conditions. To provide context, at 10:20 p.m. a.m. yesterday, the Palisades Fire was at 10 acres. 12 minutes later, it was at 200 acres. I know the world is looking at images of our city's devastation. I have seen the front lines of the Palisades Fire, and it is staggering.
Mayor Bass has been criticized for leaving Los Angeles on a diplomatic trip to Ghana over the weekend as warnings about the imminent disaster were ramping up. L.A. residents are also directing ire at Bass and the L.A. City Council, which cut the fire department's budget by over $17 million this fiscal year, while increasing the budget of the LAPD by nearly $126 million. Meanwhile, housing advocates are urging officials to do more to assist the 70,000 unhoused people in L.A. who lack access to shelters and to personal protective equipment to protect their lungs from the thick smoke blanketing much of the city. Southern California faces year-round wildfire risks due to the worsening climate catastrophe. We'll go to California for the latest later in the broadcast. Gaza's health ministry says Israeli attacks over the past 24 hours have killed at least 70 Palestinians, injured over 100 others. Among the dead, or at least 8 people killed in northern Gaza in an Israeli strike on a home in Jabalia al-Balad. Some of the Gaza's remaining hospitals are scaling back services amidst Israel's severe restrictions on fuel supplies. At Al-Aqsa Hospital, Doctors Without Borders reports 15 newborns in incubators could soon die unless Israel urgently allows the delivery of fuel to power the hospital's generators. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Wednesday mocked President-elect Donald Trump's proposal to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Sheinbaum was speaking to reporters at her daily news conference in front of a large map from 1607 that labeled much of the North American continent America Mexicana or Mexican America.
The United Nations recognizes the name Gulf of Mexico. But next, why don't we call it Mexican America? It sounds nice, doesn't it? Since 1607, the Constitution of Apatzingan was Mexican America. So let's call it Mexican America. It sounds nice, doesn't it? Gulf of Mexico since 1607, and it is also internationally recognized.
European leaders have reacted with alarm to Donald Trump's proposal to seize control of the Panama Canal and Greenland and vow to defend the national sovereignty of European nations. On Wednesday, Denmark's foreign minister said Greenland may become independent if its residents decide to, but it will not become part of the U.S. He made the remarks as Donald Trump Jr. visited Nuuk, Greenland, where at a news conference he promised residents, quote, "We're going to treat you well." The Justice Department says it plans to publicly release special counsel Jack Smith's findings on Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. But it will not release the part of special counsel Smith's report concerning Trump's mishandling of classified documents as legal proceedings continue for two of Trump's co-conspirators. Those findings will only be released to select lawmakers on the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. Both cases against Trump were dropped after Trump won re-election in November. It's not clear when the partial report might become available after Trump appointed Judge Aileen Cannon, who last summer dismissed Trump's classified documents case, temporarily blocked the release of Smith's report on Tuesday. Meanwhile, Trump has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to block sentencing scheduled for Friday in his New York hush money case and the 2016 election subversion conviction. ABC News reports Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito spoke to Trump on the phone shortly before Trump's request. Alito claimed the call was related to a job reference for a former clerk. The White House on Wednesday announced another $500 million in military aid package to Ukraine, its last before President Biden leaves office. The Biden administration is also expected to announce new sanctions on Russia this week. In Ukraine, Russian shelling killed at least 13 people and wounded 32 others in the southern city of Zaporizhia on Wednesday. Some of the dead were killed while headed home from work on a bus.
People were leaving from their shift through the main entrance of the building, and that's when the attack came. There were two very loud explosions.
I see that people were inside your bus.
Yes, two people were killed and two others were wounded. Two were killed.
How many people were here, and how many people were killed in total?
There was a lot. It happened exactly when people ended their shift.
The government of Chad says it repelled an armed attack on the presidential palace Wednesday, killing at least 18 assailants, they said. One member of Chad's security forces reportedly died. The perpetrators have not been identified, but early reports blame the attack on Boko Haram. The attack came hours after the Chadian president, Mohamed Idriss Deby, met with China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, during an official visit to N'Djamena. It also comes just weeks after contested parliamentary elections. Deby seized power in Chad after his father, longstanding President Idriss Deby, was killed by rebel forces in 2021. Chad's among a growing number of former French colonies that have expelled French fighters in recent months. Lebanon's parliament has voted to elect a president, filling a leadership vacuum for the first time in over 2 years. Joseph Aoun received 99 out of 128 votes with support across Lebanon's political spectrum, including among Hezbollah politicians. His election could help unlock funds from foreign donors as Lebanon seeks to rebuild from Israel's weeks-long bombing campaign and invasion last year. The Italian journalist Cecilia Sala landed in Rome Wednesday after 3 weeks of detention in Iran. Italian media says Sala's arrest may have been part of an Iranian plan to negotiate the release of one of their citizens who was recently detained by Italian authorities on a U.S. warrant. Mohammed Abedini is accused of being involved in an attack on a U.S. base in Jordan last year. A wide-ranging strike that would have shut down East Coast and Gulf Coast ports next week has been averted for now as the Longshoremen's Union reached a tentative deal Wednesday guaranteeing job protections from automated technology and major wage increases. Union members must still vote on the agreement. In other labor news, the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, is joining the AFL-CIO, adding roughly 2 million members to the 13 million-strong group, which includes workers across more than 50 other unions. The move reunites the two powerful labor groups after they parted ways nearly two decades ago and as the incoming Trump administration's expected to launch new attacks on workers' rights. In North Carolina, the Republican-dominated state Supreme Court has blocked election officials from certifying the re-election of Democratic Justice Allison Riggs. Riggs beat her Republican rival Jefferson Griffin in November's election by 734 votes, a tally which was confirmed by two recounts. Griffin is attempting to disqualify the votes of some 60,000 North Carolinians in order to overturn his loss, but has failed to provide any evidence the votes were unlawful. Here in New York, hundreds of immigrant justice activists rallied at the state capitol in Albany Wednesday to demand Governor Kathy Hochul and lawmakers immediately enact legislation to protect immigrant New Yorkers ahead of Trump's return to office. The bills include measures preventing cooperation with ICE and providing legal services to those who need it. Angel Reyes Rivas from the group Make the Road New York says he fears for his mixed status family.
New York State cannot be reactive. We need to be proactive. We shouldn't wait for Trump to be elected to start pushing for this, right? We need to make sure that New York State becomes a state that is an example to the nation on how to treat people, how to treat immigrants, how to uphold human rights.
And the funeral for President Carter is being held today at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. All five living presidents are attending. President Biden is giving the eulogy. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the fires in Los Angeles. But first, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg announces sweeping changes to Facebook and Instagram, including ending fact-checking in the United States. We'll speak with Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa in the Philippines and others. Stay with us.
All I hear them is about a war on crime and pollution and them economic solutions. Sure. We don't want no capitalists. I assess them out with I'm and Charlie. And we don't want no big business plan. We don't want no promise from the UN. Hear me now. Just take a look how the world is. It's a handful of man run the world business. For 2,000 years them a plan this. It's so deep them no care if me sang it. Them deep with science and I use it against we people. Say we men figure through this. But poverty is no accident. They mashing up the world with them roads and cement. We no want no capitalists. I assess them out with I'm and Charlotte. When they on ya. And we no want no big business plan. Never know.
No Capitalist by Kabaka Pyramid. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Out with the fact checkers. That was the message delivered by Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg as he announced sweeping changes at Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Zuckerberg outlined the new changes in a video posted online.
The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech. So we're going to get back to our roots and focus on reducing mistakes simplifying our policies, and restoring free expression on our platforms. First, we're going to get rid of fact checkers and replace them with community notes similar to X, starting in the US. After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US.
That's Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Nicole Gill, the head of Accountable Tech, called Meta's move a, quote, gift to Donald Trump and extremists around the world. The decision comes weeks after Zuckerberg dined with Trump at Mar-a-Lago and after Meta donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration. On Tuesday, Meta also appointed a close Trump ally, Dana White, to the company's board. White is the CEO of Ultimate Fighting Championship. Trump praised the new Meta policies.
Honestly, I think they've come a long way, Meta, Facebook. I think they've come a long way.
Mark Zuckerberg also announced other changes, including a loosening of rules over what kind of content can be posted on Facebook and the other sites. Under the changes, women can be referred to as household objects. Meta users will once again be allowed to say gay and trans people have mental illness and more. To talk about what Meta's new policies mean in the U.S. and worldwide, we're joined by three guests. In Manila, Philippines, we're joined by Maria Ressa, founder, CEO, and executive editor of the Philippine independent news site Rappler. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021 for her work defending free expression in the Philippines. Her book is titled How to Stand Up to a Dictator, The Fight for Our Future. Siva Vaidyanathan is the author of Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. He's professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His piece for The Guardian just out, Mark Zuckerberg has gone full MAGA. And in Doha, we're joined by Mark Owen Jones, associate professor of media analytics at Northwestern University in Qatar and an expert on disinformation. He's the author of Digital Authoritarianism in the Middle East, Deception, Disinformation, and Social Media. Let's begin with you, Professor Jones. digital authoritarianism. Can you talk about how Mark Zuckerberg's announcement soon after he met with Donald Trump and is giving well over $1 million to the inauguration and put one of his closest allies, Trump's allies, that is, on his board, fits into that concept and what it means, digital authoritarianism?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. I mean, digital authoritarianism, broadly speaking, is the use of digital technology for authoritarian ends. You know, it's fundamentally anti-democratic. And I think Zuckerberg's move is indicative of the authoritarian direction that the United States is going. He is essentially saying that the social media company, or Meta, is subservient to the whims of the political elite. And I think a key part of digital authoritarianism here that's really important is this notion of the post-truth. Authoritarianism thrives on the absence of facts. It thrives on a war on reality. Why is that the case? Well, because authoritarian leaders, they're not interested in the truth because the truth can be used to attack them, to discredit them, as we know that Trump was documented as being one of the most lying presidents and politicians in history. But they want an alternative reality, alternative facts. And the idea of a war on fact checkers really fits in with this, because what it means is that authoritarian leaders, they want people to respect them, they want people to fear them, they fundamentally want people to see the world through their eyes and be submissive to their wishes. And I think that's what this represents, is that Mark Zuckerberg is clearly bending the knee to Trump, not only doing his bidding, but also creating this massive donation. And I think what we need to understand about digital authoritarianism is that we are in a space where we increasingly communicate on digital technologies. Zuckerberg's move is designed not just to, quote unquote, prevent censorship. Here, censorship is a euphemism for actually harm against minorities. Some of the examples you mentioned were were women, but also transgender people, but also immigrants were mentioned by Zuckerberg himself. These are all right-wing dog whistles. Essentially what this means it's going to be is open season on these digital platforms for people to attack minorities and to harm them. It's not about reducing censorship, it's actually about increasing digital violence against minorities, which is part of the new, I would say, increasingly autocratic America.
So, Maria Ressa, could we get your response to Meta's new policies? You've said that Zuckerberg's decision would lead to, quote, a world without facts, and that that was a world that's ripe for a dictator. So could you respond to what Mark said now, and what you think this means in particular for the Philippines, for social media, social media sites in the Philippines?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Philippines, we had a bout with our own dictators starting in 2016. And I would say we were in hell under our previous president, and now we're in purgatory, while the United States is just headed to hell, it feels like. Let me quickly say, it's not a free speech issue, which is what he claims. It's a safety issue. And exactly what we just heard, what you're seeing is that now this platform, one that unites more than 3.2 billion people around the world, has declared open season on minorities. Actually, it's no longer safe for any person, because one of the things that we've learned in the Philippines is that the insidious manipulation on this takes away will. Right. So we already know around the world that it has become a platform that has enabled genocide. This is in Myanmar, in Southeast Asia. Meta itself sent a team, and they concurred with the United Nations in two separate findings. The second one is, this is a platform that hacked our biology, that changes the way we feel fear, anger, and hate, to change the way we see the world and the way we act. Election interference. What you've seen now is, as early as 2016 on Brexit, the UK actually fined Facebook then the largest amount at that point in time because of what would be equivalent to election interference. Nothing else was done beyond that. But again, part of the reason the world is where it is, where as of last year, 71% of the world is under authoritarian rule. We are electing illiberal leaders democratically, partly because our public information ecosystem, social media, Facebook, is corrupting our individual communications with each other, taking away agency.
And Maria, could you say specifically, I mean, in a place like the Philippines, there's almost 90% of the population in the Philippines is on Facebook. And how is Facebook used, not only in terms of posting information, but also as a means of communication, and the way in which misinformation has spread on Facebook in the past, not only, of course, in Myanmar, which is the example that you cited, but also in the Philippines and elsewhere?
I mean, very specifically, our past president, Rodrigo Duterte, used the design of what was an advertising and marketing platform of Facebook to do information operations. I was getting an average of 90 hate messages per hour, free speech used to stifle free speech. But beyond that, these networks of information warfare, networks of disinformation, literally changed our history in front of our eyes, setting the stage for the election of Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the only son of our dictator who was in power for 21 years, Ferdinand Marcos. You'll remember Imelda Marcos and her shoes. Her son, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., won overwhelmingly in our presidential elections because literally Filipinos were taught in information operations, YouTube, Meta, and Facebook, that that Marcos was not a dictator in 1986, ousted in people power. Instead, he was the greatest leader the Philippines has ever known.
Into 2021, the Rohingya refugees actually sued Facebook's parent company, Meta, over its failure to stop violent hate speech on its platform, which contributed to the bloody military crackdown of the Rohingya Muslim community by the military in 2017 in Burma, also known as Myanmar. Law firms in the U.S. and U.K. launched a legal effort on behalf of the Rohingya around the world, including in Bangladeshi refugee camps. Plaintiffs demanded over $150 billion in damages. The U.N. found as many as 10,000 Rohingya were killed by Burmese forces during the 2017 genocide, though some estimates put the death toll at twice that. Over another 730,000 people were forced to flee the country. I just want to go to a quick video, part of a video, produced by Amnesty, featuring a survivor of the Rohingya genocide.
My name is Saidullah. I am from Myanmar, but now I am living in Bangladesh, Cox's Bazar, as a forcibly displaced Myanmar national.
I personally experienced that online hate speech turned into offline hate for us. There were many different things on Facebook against us, which turned the people of Myanmar against us. I saw many different anti-Rohingya posts on Facebook. For example, I still remember a post that said, "The birth rate of these Bengali Rohingya people is very high. If it remains continuously like this, we will become their slaves." Now they are our slaves. Let's go for action. I knew about the option of reporting hate speech to Facebook. I already reported some hate speech to Facebook, but it only said, "Thank you for reporting. This post doesn't go against our community standards."
I wanted to bring Siva Vaidyanathan into this conversation, author of Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, a professor at the University of Virginia. And I wanted to go to this issue of hate and how deadly it can be, whether we're talking about Burma, Myanmar, or whether we're talking about the United States. I mean, you have, just giving a bunch of examples, roughly 7 in 10 lesbian, gay, bisexual adults have encountered any harassment online. Fully 51% have been targeted for more severe forms of online abuse. You have roughly about a third of women under 35 may have been sexually harassed online. You have a study of 51 countries reveals 38% of women had personally experienced online harassment. Professor Vaidyanathan, if you can talk about the connection to hate and how that connects to, well, your headline of your Guardian piece, Mark Zuckerberg has gone full MAGA.
Right. Well, let's be clear about this change. And I'm really thrilled that you've started this conversation by going beyond the United States. What Mark Zuckerberg announced the other day clearly only applies to the United States in terms of its specificity. In the United States, since 2017, Meta has been trying to at least appear that it's taking content moderation seriously. And let's remember, the proper phrase to describe what we're talking about is content moderation. Fact-checking was never part of the formula. It's not about facts. It's about protecting users. It's about protecting people from things like harassment, from protecting groups of people from campaigns and movements. People like the citizens of my town, Charlottesville, Virginia, who encountered a flood of violent right-wingers in the summer of 2017 through a movement that was largely organized through Facebook. So the idea here, and why Zuckerberg has appeared before Congress multiple times, swearing that he's doing a good job, has all been about the United States. The content moderation policies and procedures and infrastructure beyond the United States have never been sufficient and have never been serious, with the exception of Western Europe. Facebook, like every other digital media company, pays particular attention to the demands and laws of the countries in which it operates. And therefore, it didn't pay much attention to the demands of content moderation and protecting users in the Philippines. It's never paid attention to protecting users in India or in Pakistan in Cambodia, in Uzbekistan. These are places where tremendous propaganda flows through Facebook channels unmitigated. Now, the United States question, though, in this sense is, what is Zuckerberg changing? Zuckerberg is scrapping a rather elaborate and expensive system that sort of worked to keep the Nazis at bay and to somewhat limit things like harassment and somewhat make sure that the user experience in the United States is not horrifying the way that one would encounter horrifying material on X today, for instance. He's gone against that. And I think it's wrong to think of this as a pandering to Trump or getting down on his knee to Trump. It's actually just the opposite. In the United States, the government is subservient to corporations, especially this corporation. Zuckerberg always gets what he wants out of the United States government. He sees an opportunity to get even more of what he wants out of the Trump administration, because what he wants is to be able to threaten and win in a power struggle against Lula in Brazil, who has put forth very strong regulations against all social media companies. So Zuckerberg absolutely cares more about Brazil than he does the United States. Brazil is still one of the most fervent and potentially important growth markets for Meta. He's extremely concerned that the United States be able to use its power to limit regulation in Europe as well. So what he's hoping is Trump's irascible, off-the-hook, unpredictable foreign policy, throwing sticks around the world, might help limit Europe's willingness to regulate Facebook and Brazil's willingness to regulate Facebook. This is all about opportunity, not subservience. He is hoping that, once again, the U.S. government is subservient to Facebook.
So, Mark Owen-Jones, if you could respond to what Meta has said the new form of content moderation will be, this idea of community notes, which is what is operative on Elon Musk's X, and why you think this decision has been taken now and what the effect will be.
Well, I think it's very clear that the community note system, which involves basically a certain group of, in X's case, sort of anointed fact checkers, not fact checkers, sort of people commenting on viral posts to determine whether it's truthful or not, is really problematic. It doesn't work. And there's a number of reasons why it doesn't work, because essentially what it's resulted in is people not correcting facts, but people just posting their opinions as fact. So what we're getting is not fact-checking, or in theory, content moderation. We're getting this relativization of truth where people just respond to some information that they disagree with politically or for some other reason, and then say the opposite. And so all you're doing is getting this kind of situation where it's not even about verifiable facts anymore, but just about presenting an alternative opinion. And I think the reason, I mean, this is going to be rolled out, we're not quite sure, on Meta's platforms, but it won't work. And crucially, I think there's another point here that's very interesting. Firstly, for the Zuckerberg, him abandoning this fact-checking system is going to save him money. The idea of community notes is also, in theory, going to increase engagement, which might mean more profit for Facebook. But fundamentally, what it's going to do is just actually create a space in which people are going to engage in increasingly contentious arguments. And there's a really important point we need to bear in mind here, is that community notes also implies that there's a level playing field when it comes to the kind of information that's put out there on Facebook, right? We don't know which posts are getting promoted, which posts will get community noted. We also know that, and I really want to make this point, is that sometimes this community notes thing is framed as a bottom-up form of free speech. It allows users to engage in debate. It's not about free speech. It's about the free market of speech. And the difference is that the free market of speech allows people with authority, influence, to actually have a louder voice than others, whether that's paid advertisers or Facebook's algorithms deciding which information gets promoted more and therefore community noted. And that's really important, because we know from Facebook, all this talk of free speech is misleading, because Facebook have been known through their testing to promote content that is quote unquote bad for the world, the kind of content that will make you angry or potentially laugh. So Facebook are in the business of modulating public conversations. And this community notes thing is a smokescreen to suggest that Facebook are actually permitting free speech and user-led fact-checking. It's a system that won't work, and it's a system that will just lead to increased polarization and the undermining of democracy by polluting the information space with ideological disinformation.
Professor Vaidyanathan, Zuckerberg said in his announcement Wednesday that Meta's moving its trust and safety content moderation teams out of California to Texas, a move he said would, quote, help us build trust to do this work in places where there's less concern about the bias of our teams. Now, this comes after the Elon Musk-founded companies Tesla and SpaceX changed their incorporation state from Delaware to Texas, run, of course, with Republican leadership from Senator Ted Cruz to the governor of Texas. Talk about the significance of this. And as you talk about, you know, Meta going MAGA.
Yeah, I mean, it's purely symbolic. It has no operational significance. You know, the people who work in that field, and there will be many fewer of them, that's important. But the people who work in that field, it doesn't matter where they sit, right? They're trained the same way. They have to follow the same rules. It's a very structured system for content moderation. The real question here is all of those thousands of contracted workers, many of whom were in English-speaking countries or partially English-speaking countries around the world, low-wage workers, people in places like India and the Philippines, people who were subjected to hours and hours of horrible images and videos, animal mutilation, child abuse, horrible violence. Their fate is that basically they won't have any jobs anymore, which, you know, they had horrible jobs before, but those contracts will all be canceled. The small group of domestic Facebook employees will be moved to Texas, or I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. And he may not even follow through on it, right? There's no reason to believe anything he said. No one will hold him to it. And I don't think it means much, except that it was a symbolic or signal to a symbolic signal to the Republicans that this is some sort of candy for them. But I don't think it's going to change the Facebook experience in any significant way. What really will change the Facebook experience is the fact that Community Notes will fail, and that our Facebook and Instagram experiences will be filled with hate speech almost immediately. It's going to become deeply unpleasant. The real question is, will it become so unpleasant for advertisers that they start pushing back at Meta? And if that happens, because that's the only other countervailing power at work in this system, then there could be another correction to this policy. And I wouldn't be surprised by that. Zuckerberg has no principles on these matters, except that what is good for Facebook is good for the world. And everything he does follows from that.
So, Maria Ressa, so as Siva said, now we can anticipate that these platforms are being filled with hate speech. You've said that you will do everything possible to, quote, ensure information integrity. So tell us, how do you think individuals and independent news organizations like yours can ensure that there is a truthful fact checked information available as these sites get flooded with misinformation?
Well, it's already happened, right? Cory Doctorow coined the phrase the enshittification of the internet. And in fact, I don't know if you guys saw Shrimp Jesus on Facebook, right? AI generated crap. And Facebook says that it's going to be adding more of this. So I think the first step is to actually do what we did, which is to collaborate. The way we were able to take over the center of the Facebook information ecosystem was by creating something we called Facts First PH, a collaboration of about 150 different groups, four-layer pyramid. The bottom were 16 news organizations working together, right? So fact checks don't distribute, don't spread as fast and as far as lies laced with fear, anger, and hate. So what do? Well, you have 16 news groups doing daily fact checks, but the second layer, that's civil society groups, the church, business groups. That's the group that is essentially distribution. We called it the mesh layer. We organized ourselves so that every person in these groups will share one fact check every day, but will share it with emotion. The third layer were academic partners of ours. We gave a pipeline of the fact checks of the data, and every week, the academic, because again, who are the first groups under attack? Just like Mark Zuckerberg said in that quote, the journalists. So as credibility was pushing backwards because we're under constant attack, the academe came in, and every week leading up to our 2022 elections, academics came in and told people what meta-narratives were being seeded, what was going viral, which candidate was actually winning in this. And finally, the last layer is lawyers. Six different law groups, left, right, and center, that protected rule of law. You cannot have rule of law without integrity of facts. And just 3 or 4 days before our elections, we did take over the center of the Facebook information ecosystem. But here's your problem. Just in order to have facts, you have to work quadruple, four times, five times harder, and you have to collaborate more. That's an interim solution. The longer term solution, of course, is the other group that's abdicated responsibility for protecting the public are actually democratic governments who failed to build a public tech stack. This is not a free speech issue. Again, just to pull together, right? This is, in the end, Facebook is after power and money, and President Trump gave his blessing. Mark Zuckerberg now feels more comfortable. Maybe the cases won't come, right? That's what you're seeing jostling. But the second part is it will. Surveillance capitalism, unchecked, will bring Facebook more money, a company that makes more than $300 billion a year at the expense of the safety of the people on the platform.
We're going to leave it there. And of course, Mark Zuckerberg does face, as CEO of Meta, in the coming months under President Trump, the FTC case around the breakup of Meta, something he's concerned about losing billions over. Maria Ressa, founder, CEO, and executive editor of the Philippine independent news site Rappler, Nobel Peace Prize winner for her work defending free expression. Mark Owen Jones, professor at Northwestern University and Qatar, author of Digital Authoritarianism in the Middle East, Deception, Disinformation, and Social Media. And Siva Vaidyanathan, author of Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, professor at the University of Virginia. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian. Mark Zuckerberg has gone full MAGA. Next up to Los Angeles, where the devastating fires have killed at least five, destroyed 2,000 homes and buildings. More than 130,000 people have been evacuated. We'll look at what's happening, hear the story of one person who had to evacuate her whole family, and then talk about the world on fire. We'll talk about climate change. Back in 20 seconds. A voice from on high by the late Charlie Hayden, who lived in L.A. To see our interview with him, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the wildfire scorching communities across Los Angeles in one of the city's most destructive firestorms in history. Over 100,000 people have been evacuated, more than 2,000 structures have been damaged or destroyed, and at least five people are dead, a toll that's expected to rise. One of five fires now burning started Tuesday in the Pacific Palisades neighborhood, which has now burned some 17,000 acres. The Eaton Fire burned more than 10,000 acres. Fires also prompted evacuations in the Hollywood Hills and Studio City. On Wednesday, President Biden pledged assistance from the Department of Defense. This comes as Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass and City Council are facing new scrutiny for cutting the fire department's funding by around 2% while increasing the police department budget. Nearly 400 incarcerated firefighters are among those deployed to battle the fires. Democracy Now! Reached former incarcerated firefighter Amika Mota with the Sister Warriors Freedom Coalition.
You know, and many of these people are going home tonight to cells, to fire camps. Also in Malibu, you know, we have a fire camp there that is under threat. We're really concerned about the folks there. We also know that there's a youth fire camp in Malibu. So we have a lot of young people facing some pretty terrible conditions. I can also say that we're really concerned. You know, Karen Bass has ordered an evacuation within a mile of the juvenile hall in Sylmar, where we have 100 incarcerated young people. So we're also really thinking about, you know, our currently incarcerated folks that are really vulnerable to these conditions.
To see our interview with incarcerated firefighters, you can go to democracynow.org. But right now, for more on the unprecedented fires and the role of climate change, we're joined by two guests. In Dana Point, California, about 50 miles south of L.A., John Valiant is an award-winning journalist, author of several books, including Fire Weather on the Front Lines of a Burning World, finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award. And in Pasadena, we're joined by Sonali Kohatkar, who evacuated with her family, her kids, and her parents from the fires. Award-winning journalist, author, and host of the radio and TV show Rising Up with Sonali. Her forthcoming book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sonali, please describe what you have gone through with your family and how you escaped the fires.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's, you know, you don't expect that you're going to be in the middle of a disaster that captures international attention. And in my sleepy town of North Pasadena, I'm just two blocks from Altadena, that's precisely what has happened. We heard the winds rattling in the middle of the night, more ferocious than they'd ever been. We knew that we hadn't had rain in hundreds of days. And, you know, we have our neighborhood chat group and people started talking about whether they should up and leave. I have two elderly disabled parents, and I decided that I would evacuate them before the official evacuation notice came. And already the hotels were filling up on Monday night. You know, we luckily had power, but many of our neighbors didn't. And we've been holed up at this hotel. All the hotels are packed. The convention center up the street is packed. It's just devastating. 1,100 businesses in Altadena, this community of incredible people, has been utterly devastated. The speed, the ferocity with which these winds have blown the fires has been hard to imagine. I went back yesterday to get my father's medications because he's a diabetic and we couldn't find his meds at the pharmacies. And I just, you know, risked it, went home and grabbed the medication. The air was thick with smoke and ash raining down. And all I could think of was this house that I've lived in for more than half my life is still standing, but I don't know if it's going to be standing tomorrow or the day after. And, you know, my husband and I, Jim and I, went back there and we thought, you know, should we hose it down? But then it'll take water from the firefighters. The air is so bad right now that I'm sitting in the hotel lobby miles away from the fires. And the internal air is hard to breathe and I'm having to use a mask. It is just unbelievable. I feel like it is a nightmare. And I have more than 12 people in my 13 people I'm counting now in my network of friends who have just lost their homes. And I know many more have that I'm not even aware of. absolutely lost their homes. I saw some of them on Saturday at my birthday party, and now their homes are gone. And I can't even picture that. And I don't know if I will have a home tomorrow or the day after, because these winds are not over. They're dry. They're rushing through ferociously. The firefighters are overstretched. There were fire trucks that were speeding past burning homes because they didn't have enough firefighters to stop and put out the fires there. And so some people are staying because they think that if they make a stand, they can, you know, save their homes. They're risking their lives. And it's a tempting prospect because your whole life is in your home. What do I do with my parents and my kids if I don't have a home to go back to tomorrow or the day after? I don't know. This is, it's just, it's mind-blowing. It's devastating. And no one's talking about climate change in the media. No one's talking about it. And it's just, you know, it's frustrating. So just if you believe in a God, pray for us.
So, John Valiant, could you respond to these devastating accounts that Sonali has just given us of what's happening and what she herself and her family have experienced as they've had to flee, and talk about this issue, the issue of climate change? You've spoken about this concept of wildland-urban interface and why we all have to understand what that means.
Yeah, good morning, Nermeen, and Sonali, I'm really, really sorry to hear what you're going through. And this might be cold comfort, but I've spent the last 8 years studying fires like this and talking to people who've gone through what you're going through right now, many of whom lost their homes ultimately. We're in a situation now, we're realizing, or LA residents are waking up to the fact that the climate really owns our communities. It owns our landscape. And LA County, you know, the most populous urban region in the country, is now literally at the mercy of fire. And it's at the mercy of climate. And as Sonali said, it's desperately dry there, and the winds are still blowing, and the winds control these fires. Despite the fact that California is famous for its devastating fires and has lost thousands and thousands of homes over the past 30 years to major fires just like these, it's still shocking when it happens to you. I think all of us human beings are defended against that possibility, even when it's happening all around us. And in this case, in other parts of California, now it's LA County's moment to experience this. And nothing really prepares you for the kind of psychic and physical assault of these kinds of fires. And this notion of the wildland-urban interface, known to firefighters as the WUI, is that place where the wildland, you know, the hills of the San Gabriel Mountains, San Fernando Valley, butt up against the built environment, the places where we live. And increasingly, very powerful fires are coming into cities, into urban spaces from these wildlands. And the interface is where they meet. And what is really alarming, and it's another thing people don't talk about, is what excellent fuel the modern house is. So these wildfires are raging through forest, which is natural. Their fire is a normal part of the California landscape. But coming into these built environments, houses nowadays, the modern house has so many petroleum products in it, in terms of vinyl siding and formica counters and polyurethane stuffing and the rubber tires and the gas tanks in the garage. There are all kinds of explosive petroleum products built into our lives that we don't even think about. Look at what your shoes are made out of. When they get hot enough, they are explosively flammable. It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. And if you start looking around at your home, you'll realize that petroleum and its products are everywhere. And these are really, really flammable. And in the case of LA County right now, the other kind of sort of secret accelerant is humidity. And you're down close to 0% humidity, which is drier than kindling, drier than a matchstick. And now you have entire communities that are this dry. So the fire has to do very little work to get going. And it's got these sometimes 50, 80 mile an hour winds fanning, not just fanning the flames, but really turning them into blow torches, blowing through these communities. It's devastating energy. Firefighters can't really fight it. And that's why you have such a low percentage of containment on these massive fires that have already done colossal damage.
And yet, John, you have the media, and I'm not just talking Fox. I'm talking about all the networks. They'll talk about the perfect storm that's going on now, the high winds, extremely dry weather, especially since October. But they won't talk about climate change. The weather centers should be renamed climate change centers. But this hesitance to link it to the rest of the world and to this global heating that's happening right now and what it would mean for policy as a new president comes in, whose main motto is drill, baby, drill.
Yeah, there's a real moral cowardice in evidence at the government level, at the media level. There is no doubt about the hand-in-hand connection between our obsession with fossil fuel burning, which goes back, you know, for 200 years now, and the alterations in the climate in terms of the buildup of heat-trapping CO2 and methane. And were they, those companies and government and the governments and banks who enable them to acknowledge this, they would have to change their business model. And this kind of blind, frankly, suicidal loyalty to the status quo of keeping fossil fuels preeminent in our energy system is creating an increasingly difficult situation and unlivable situation. And I think, you know, some billionaires were impacted over the past couple of days, billionaires who encourage these policies. And yet their inclination is to blame the mayor, to blame the governor for conditions that predate either of their administrations. And so we're really, what we're living in right now is an increasingly shrill dissonance between the fact of climate change, the science of climate change, which is well understood by NOAA, by NASA, by many brave meteorologists who are on television and on the radio, and the governments who are serving really handmaidens to the petroleum industry and to the investors who are dependent on keeping them in business.
Well, Sonali, you know, if you could talk about, you're one of the few journalists who's insisted on centering the issue of the climate crisis in your reporting. So if you could talk about that and also your assessment of how the city, Los Angeles, has dealt with these devastating fires. The mayor has come under a lot of criticism. There haven't been enough firefighters, cuts to the fire department. Sonali.
Yes, thank you so much. You're right. The fact that we keep pouring money into enforcing racial capitalism, the fact that we keep pouring money into ensuring that that policing is always well funded while fire departments are not, that our resilience, our climate resilience is not funded, that's a matter of priorities. It's something I talk about in my new book, talking about abolition. But this is, you know, how we design city budgets is a blueprint for how we want to live. And so if we're pouring money into policing and taking money out of firefighting, if we're pouring money into, you know, our tax dollars going to subsidizing oil companies, but not, you know, enough subsidies to renewable energy, to electric vehicles, to climate adaptability, then we are basically reaping what we sow. And we have to be connecting these dots, because whenever you hear the sort of media coverage about these disasters, they're covered as one-offs, as isolated incidents, that here's this devastating fire, you know, we were praying for you, you know, you'll survive. Look at the community spirit. I don't want to have to just survive. I don't want to have to rely on community spirit and my neighbors and GoFundMes to figure out, you know, where I'm going to be living next. I want my tax dollars to go towards taking care of me, my community, and all of us being together. So we need a cultural shift in our country, away from thinking individualistically about the biggest car we can drive and the you know, the ways in which we can protect ourselves without thinking about how we protect our community and how we're all in this together. So we have to fight for control over our budgets. We have to fight for control over the priorities that we make pouring them into climate resiliency and adaptation, and ending the stranglehold of fossil fuels over our country and our world. We have to change that cultural mindset, and we have to push our politicians to do the right thing. And billionaires should not exist.
We have to leave it there right now, but we will certainly continue to cover all these issues. Sonali, it is hard to wish you a happy birthday, but on your landmark birthday, we're thinking of you. Sonali Kahatkar, evacuated host of
Fiber Plus Internet, is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.